Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. This is your host, Dan Turchin, advisor at Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. Thanks again to all of our loyal listeners for helping us turn a passion project into one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you like what we do, please like, comment, and share this episode in your favorite podcast app. Your feedback means a ton to us. In fact, we may even read some comments from the mailbag in upcoming episodes. So keep that feedback coming. It's appreciated. Today's guest is no stranger to enterprise IT. He's been in the space as a practitioner and analyst for, nearly 20 years. Ken's current role at Gartner puts him in the catbird seat to educate and learn from some of the best CIOs out there. He's the expert at Gartner on IT metrics and organizational change. We recently discussed the evolving role of the CIO a few weeks back with Diane Hinchcliffe. We're going to expand on that discussion today and learn what Ken's hearing in the trenches. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome Ken Gonzalez to the podcast. Ken, welcome. Why don't you share a little bit about your background and how you got into this space?
Hi, Dan. Well, first off, thank you for the invitation to be here. It's a real pleasure. And let's see, where did it all start? I'll correct you just a little bit because it's not 20 years. It's actually, as of last count, 35. But if I were to think about how long I've been dealing in the area of service management, that's probably around 20 years, maybe a little bit beyond that. I actually came from hardcore telecommunications, working with systems, switching systems, PBXs, and things like that. And I found that I had a very good knack for programming things, which actually got me into the IT industry and actually doing software development. So I started doing software development projects, moved on to being able to start teaching software development at Cal State Fullerton, and then ultimately got into the vendor world. And I've pretty much been either in vendor organizations or consulting organizations since. And it's been a real journey.
A lot of our listeners probably don't understand what it means to be an analyst. Talk us through a day in your life.
Well, so it's interesting because it's like a job that no one has ever had before. Or let me put it to you like this: it's very transactional in that you get a very short time to interact with somebody. And just so we're clear, I'm not here in my official capacity as a Gartner representative, but really as a longtime industry professional. And but the nature of an analyst's world and an advisor's world is, how do you help people in a very targeted and effective manner? So people will have questions, they will have issues, they will have things that they want to know something about. So that's the basis on which an engagement is set up. And based upon the information that they provide us, I'll actually work with somebody to listen deeply about what their concern is, and then try to line that up, number one, with any published research that's been put out that we expect people are going to consume. Or how can we take and use that as a way of being able to frame the next actions that we hope people will be able to take that are going to address the issue that they're seeing. And last time I checked, I've done over basically 2,500 of these analyst inquiry calls over the past 5 years. And the thing that's really distinct about it, when you have that kind of interaction with that many organizations, it gives you a different perspective on what the whole thing is actually doing. You get a different sense of how markets move, what people are paying attention to en masse. So it's really quite special. I am not the person I was when I started doing this job, and it's really fundamentally changed me, I think, in a lot of good ways. I'm more capable now than I ever was before, and that's a good thing.
Ken, you're an Iron Man. That is quite a feat. Now, we've had some colorful discussions with analysts on this podcast. I recall some fun exchanges with Colin Fletcher, who was formerly at Gartner.
Oh yes,
who famously coined the term AI ops. He taught us how to make fried chicken, by the way. So I'm not going to ask you to teach us how to cook anything, but I am going to ask you to tell us a story about a memorable client engagement, something that just stands out as being unique, outrageous, memorable in some way.
Unique, outrageous, or memorable. I'll go back to when I first started in 2016, and probably one of the first calls I had was a customer who wanted me to review a consulting opportunity that they were engaging in. And one of the things I had the opportunity to do was really being kind of green and not knowing the whole thing about what the analyst life is all about. In the course of the first 30 minutes, and this is probably one of the first 20 calls I took as an analyst, I was able to help them refine their scope of work and save about $750,000 on what they were being pitched by their consulting provider. Now, I'm not going to end up on that provider's Christmas card list by any stretch of the imagination, but I did help the customer. And that was a really tremendously satisfying experience for me. And I know that they got value from it that they could take to the bank. And that's really cool.
I know one thing about you, it's that you're not particularly shy. And and I know, like us on this program, you think a lot about the future of work and the future of the employee experience. Mm-hmm. What is one opinion that you hold strongly that might be controversial in the broader industry?
Interesting. I would say that if there is anything that the whole move to product centricity is a long time in coming. And at one point, I probably would have described it as looking at employee experience design or something along the lines. But I really think that fundamentally, product management is the key shift that I've been wanting people to make. Because fundamentally, IT organizations do not do a good job of being able to manage themselves in the way that they probably have thought. In the past, it's been described as, the managing the business of IT. I think that's a great catchphrase, and we just don't do it. We have no sense of cost, what it costs to do things, except for, we get budgets and we try to live within the budget. But generally speaking, we deal with it as a set of constraints. And our reaction to it is, we're going to work longer. We're going to work harder. We're going to do more. It's all about raw effort, like trying to save the day, instead of actually being really thoughtful about what should we be doing? What should we not be doing? What should we put out of service? How can we actually ensure that we're serving what people need, as opposed to, that's the way we've always done it. So that's where we're going to continue to do it. Moving to product management actually has us not only take those things into consideration, but it forces us now to take a whole life cycle view of what gets built. So we can't just focus on, we did a great job of planning and building. We stick to our budget and now we produce the thing. But can we afford to operate it long term? Does it provide the value that we need it to for our organization at the required level of cost? Is the cost of support actually reasonable? Can we continue to operate it and expect it's going to do the things that people need it to do? And the last piece is, how does it need to evolve over time? Because we need to budget for that as well. These are dimensions that many of the IT leaders I see are just like a deer in headlights with it. No clue. And it's not like they're bad people or they're not trying, but it's a friend of mine referred to it as the Red Queen problem. I keep running faster and faster, just trying to stay in place. And that is fundamentally unsustainable. And we need to take that one out behind the barn and shoot it, because we're done.
Stick to your guns. I'm with you. Well said. Now, you speak with a lot of CIOs, and I know that a lot of them these days are wrestling with, call it on one end of the spectrum, I need to make investments in security, data privacy, kind of KTLO kinds of operational things. And then on the right side, the business is asking me to transform them digitally and innovate. Are those two ends of a spectrum? And how do you coach CIOs about how to think about making investments in innovation without necessarily cannibalizing the KTLO and the operational aspects of the business?
Well, so I think that the first off on the KTLO side, we have to think about what we actually do more often than not, and especially pre-COVID. I think that if there's any good thing that came from COVID as an emergency, it kind of tossed into the air any notion that, oh, the way we've been working is the way we are always going to work. I think in terms of like having a great reset opportunity, it was one of them, because it now gave us the opportunity to rethink where we do it from, how we do it, the tool sets. Now, if we only take and go from there and start to ask the question, should we be doing it at all? That's probably one of the biggest things, I think, from a KTLO perspective. We have to ask the question, because some things do not provide sufficient business value and they just need to get put out of existence, or find a better way to do them that doesn't obligate existing staff member time and attention. Now, as far as innovation goes, the interesting thing is I think that a lot of the conversations we have about innovation are focused on technology. And I'm not saying that technology doesn't hold the opportunity to drive innovation. But what I am saying is that innovation needs to have a focus. It needs to drive some sort of compelling benefit for people that are going to take advantage of it. It has to give them new sets of capabilities that they can relate to, that fit onto whatever mission essential task they need to perform on behalf of their organization. And if we don't use that as the organizing principle for how we approach it, we're going to be in the same bucket we've always been, which is, oh, I have new technology and let's go out and buy it. And quite frankly, that message is not playing well today. It costs too much, takes too long, and doesn't necessarily provide the benefit that it was intended to. So are you going to be the CFO's bet going, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to place my money on you? No, they're going to put their funds where they believe they're going to get the best investment. And if that's not in your pocket, shame on you.
Now, building on that, I'm going to make a couple big overstatements. One is that I'd say the theme in IT, call it for, you know, the first decade of the century, was run IT like a business. And that, yeah, we kind of, you know, that was a common drumbeat. And roughly speaking, second decade, we talked a lot about focus on the employee experience, modernize the tools with an eye toward the employee, as opposed to with an eye toward the tool or the process. So if you'd say, you know, loosely, there are these themes that emerge over kind of a decade, and often, to be fair, only in retrospect, prognosticate for us, what are we going to look back on in 10 or 15 years and say that was kind of the theme of the third decade of the 21st century?
I would say it's probably around being able to, how we were able to take the knowledge and skill we're developing around data and analytics and use that as a way to transform interaction models. Because for the most part, the thing that I find is, and I'm glad you mentioned Colin earlier talking about AI ops, one of the biggest things I find around that particular topic is so many vendors approach it from, hey, we've got a model, we've got a view of the world, and what we do actually makes sense from that perspective. But it doesn't map well against what a number of people are doing in the space, right? So it's fragmented. So it makes it really difficult for somebody that wants to leverage this to go and do an apples to apples comparison and say, oh, this is the thing we're going to use. Why? Because it does X, Y, and Z, and it's really a clear and compelling value proposition. The other thing I hear is that, oh, we've got all this data. We should be able to do really great things with it. And underneath that is the assumption that, well, you have data that you can use to answer interesting questions. But it's likely that that's not actually true. You may have a lot of data, but it may not actually help you come to develop a new set of insights that's really going to help you either figure out how to do something better, do something more efficiently, more effectively. You might actually need other data than that in order to build out a good machine learning model and have enough historical evidence in order to be able to train that thing and get some good sets of repeatable results. I think that making this level of knowledge, skill, and ability around data and analytics is going to be the thing that kind of pivots us into a new box where we're not having to worry about a person necessarily having to make a choice, but rather we can look at emergent behaviors of how different components actually produce outcomes and link those together in a way which is I hate to say organic because it's not really organic, but more of a natural way to see how chained outcomes actually deliver better results in ways that we may not have predicted before.
Now, if I'm doing my math right, I know it's 35 years in the space, but 20-ish years as an analyst, I think that's somewhere around an inquiry every other day. So you're meeting a lot of customers, clients, potential clients. I'd like to know, you must start to develop some real patterns. What are the watchwords, or what's the body language that indicates when you're undergoing an inquiry, you're dealing with a savvy client? What are some of the things that the most savvy or, you know, the most mature in terms of process do differently than the ones who are less mature?
They actually tell the truth about what they can do. That's probably the single biggest differentiating factor. And the second piece is that they don't get reactivated or upset when I call them on that, you know, you're really not looking at the area well, or you're not being truthful with yourself about it. Because my intent is not to embarrass, punish, or otherwise belittle people. I'm the person that gets to say that the emperor has no clothes.
To be fair, do they think they're being realistic, but you know that they're not? Or do you think they're intentionally exaggerating what they're capable of doing?
I think in a lot of cases, it really is. We believe that this is our current level of capability. And many people are shocked when I bring some points out that show that, no, actually, that's not. You're not quite where you think you are. You have an overblown sense of who you are and what you can do. And now, that's not to say that they can't get there, but certain obstacles need to get taken care of in order to be able to do that.
What are some quick wins for the ones that tend to be called low on the maturity curve that tend to come up in your briefings routinely?
Well, how about this one? Stop focusing on maturity. This is another one that, and some people might think that's a pretty heretical statement, but fact of the matter is, maturity is a lagging indicator. The thing I want people to do is I want people to focus on how readily are you able to produce the kind of outcomes that your customers care about? Do they ask how mature you are? No, that's an inwardly focused view of your self-assessment as a provider. And that counts for, you know, you could go to Starbucks and, you know, spend your money to get the latte, and that and your opinion about your level of maturity, that's about equal. Now, the thing we need to be able to focus on is how are we measured externally, where people would say, yeah, you all are doing a good job. You're getting better. And the best CIOs I've worked with them on specific strategies on how to, you know, 12 months from now, you're going to have people come up to you and say, you know, Dan, I don't know what you're doing, but things are getting better. Good job. That's the thing that I want to hear all of my customers say to me. That's what I'm playing for.
Now, this show, we focus a lot on AI and the future of work with AI technologies. But one of the things that I think is quite misunderstood, certainly in the world of IT, is why do we care? Because AI is a technology. And if we're focused on business outcomes and employee experiences, what should we think about the role of a new technology in terms of our business process? Is it, is there such thing as an AI strategy, or is it, is more of it good? Is less of it good? Is it a threat? Is it an opportunity? How would you coach, let's say, a CIO who says, hey, Ken, I need an AI strategy. What does that mean to you?
That has a couple different things that go along with it. But I think that the first part of the AI strategy has to be about culture and organizational change. Because the single biggest factor I believe that people will end up confronting sooner than later is, don't move my cheese. I've been doing what I've been doing for so long. I am comfortable with it. I like it. I don't want to do something different. As soon as we start considering AI in the role of automation and bringing things together to create new things that might require less work, might be done in new ways, might drive a whole different cost basis for being able to deliver those things, that introduces uncertainty, risk, and panic from person's perspective. If we don't get that early to understand what the shift is that people will need to make to adapt to whatever the new reality is that's driven by the use of AI or machine learning technology, it's going to be a long, hard path and likely something that people will attempt to undermine if they can to show that I am still needed. And fact of the matter is, people, I don't think anybody that's really going to be smart in the area is going to say, oh, we're trying to intentionally put people out of work or you're no longer needed. But in any of the transformation discussions I want to have with people, it's about how do we free people up to do the things that are really fitting for them, that allow them to tap into their unique abilities, and how do they contribute? If I can take away a piece that's mechanical and have you focus on a higher value activity, I'm actually getting more value for you as an employee for the salary that I spend, as well as being able to help you have a better sense of job satisfaction, because the work you're doing isn't just rubber stamp. No, it's actually leveraging your unique skills and perspectives. And the final piece about this is from like a workforce perspective, we've spent a lot of time developing technical skill. And, you know, having been in the industry as long as I have, a large part of my career had been spent on, I need to learn the latest skills, latest products, latest technology. And there comes a time when you just get tired, when you don't want to be chasing that wave anymore. And at that point, I really came to the conclusion that, you know, there's something in the people and organization dimension that's now both interesting and important to pay attention to, that just paying attention to technology alone isn't going to scratch the itch. And I think for many of the people that we're talking about potentially finding new ways for them to contribute, they need to develop core skills around relationship building, being able to collaborate effectively with others, how to organize teams, produce results. These are things that they need to be able to do. And then there's a whole other group of us that are now needing to focus on, how do you train the next generation of professional that's coming up? How do you engage in mentoring in a way that's meaningful? Be able to recreate your results in a way that they can actually take that on, be successful, and you know, you don't have to do the push-ups anymore. You can let the next generation that's interested in cutting their teeth and taking on whatever's next after that. That's the thing that's really interesting to me today, is how can I help the next generation of professional coming into the industry take advantage of both what's new, as well as stand on the shoulders of everything that, you know, folks like you and I have built.
So speaking of AI and innovation in IT, what do you think is one practice that will be commonplace at work in, call it 10 years, a decade from now, that today might just seem like science fiction?
I think the ability to actually engage in model development and just some the basic data analytics techniques and analysis, I think that's going to be just everybody will have that as part of the prerequisite for being able to be engaged. Because there's so many different areas where we don't have enough data scientists to be able to do this, you know, have a data scientist in every organization or every sub-organization. These are things that need to be part of the general skill set so that it isn't this, oh my gosh, we don't have these things. No, there are actually, this is accessible. We can engage in the training development and put the learning in place so that people can get access to these skills, this knowledge, and begin to use it in a way that's actually meaningful. Now, does that mean that they can go off and, you know, do these huge projects by themselves? No, I'm talking about, you know, basic building block kind of work. But that said, once now that becomes part of the floor, the new floor, then imagine what could be done.
We're about out of time, Ken, but I got to ask you one last question before I can let you off the hot seat.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the arc of your career. So reach way back into the depths of your history, and tell us the advice that you would give to that young version of Ken that, if I recall correctly, was graduating from flight training school.
Well, so if I would give myself one piece of advice, it would be to relax more. Because the thing that I found is many of the decisions I've made over the course of my career, number one, were unpredictable. I would never have been able to say, oh, yes, this is what I want to be when I grow up. This is the arc of my career. No, it was very much a series of happy accidents. The next thing opened up when it was ready to be there. So just relax and let it happen. Now, that's not to say you don't have to be intentional, because I think there's just a certain power and intention. Like, you may not be very capable at a point in time, but if you're intentional, you can actually develop your capability over time. So there's a relationship between the two that if you bring a certain amount of intensity to it, you're going to be successful. But I would definitely have relaxed more and not stressed about some of the things that I thought were, you know, earth-shattering or overly important at the time, and just relax into it and do what's next in front of you.
Ken, I think what we had said is we were talking offline that if you come and crush this podcast, you and I are going to drink some good beer together in Portland and talk about anything but IT. What do you say?
Absolutely. I am totally on board with this. Looking forward to it.
Post-pandemic, we're going to throw caution to the wind and hoist a pint in Portland, all right? You and me.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it, Dan.
Good. Ken, before we can wrap up here, I'm sure the audience would love to know where they can learn more about your research, get to know you a little bit better. Where can they find you?
You can find me on the web, www.kennethgonzalez.com. There's a place where you can go and send me messages. You can look at old blogs as well as new things that I'm working on writing there. So please visit and say hi. Love to hear from you.
Excellent. Well, Ken, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for hanging out. And hopefully we'll have you back maybe in less than a decade, but maybe we'll be able to talk about some of those bold ideas that you have. What do you say?
I'd welcome the opportunity, Dan, anytime.
Good stuff.
Thanks.
Dan Turchin and Ken Gonzalez signing off for this week, but we're back next week with another fascinating guest.